Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Nairobi in Kenya, and we'll be speaking with the head of the Kenyan Human Rights Commission, Mutoni Wanyeke. Yeah, this Kenya's Human Rights Commission is a non-governmental organization, and Mutoni Wanyeke is also a columnist for the weekly newspaper, The East African. We'll get an update on whether or not Kenya, the model of African democracy, will go the way of Rwanda in terms of ethnic cleansing, or whether international efforts to mediate the situation will be successful. And then we'll talk about the political earthquakes that shook both the Republican and Democratic establishments in Iowa, where Obama was the Democratic winner and Huckabee the surprise Republican winner. We'll be talking about this and its implications both for the race in New Hampshire and the subsequent primaries. We'll be speaking with David Sirota, who's a political journalist, New York Times bestselling author of Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back. He's a nationally syndicated columnist, and he also ran the successful campaigns for Ned Lamont in Connecticut until, of course, Joe Lieberman ran as an independent and got elected with Republican votes. He also ran Governor Schweitzer's successful campaign in Montana and Senator Bernie Sanders in Vermont. So we'll be talking to him about the Obama phenomenon. And then we'll talk with John Dean, who before coming counsel to the President of the United States in the age of 31, John Dean was the chief minority counsel of the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives. And he also was his Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States, and he served as Richard Nixon's White House lawyer for 1,000 days. He's authored 8 books in total, and including Conservatives Without Conscience. His latest is Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches. Let's now go to Nairobi, Kenya. I'm speaking with Mutoni Wanyeke, who is Executive Director of the Kenyan Human Rights Commission, a non-governmental organization. She's also a columnist for the weekly newspaper, The East African, and her latest column is titled, Impunity Must End at All Levels. And Mutoni, this evening in Nairobi, how is the atmosphere? One gets the impression that perhaps the worst is over?
No, not necessarily. I mean, the middle class, upper class areas of Nairobi are fine. It's true you would get the impression that not much is going on. There's a lot of tension still in the lower income areas, and we've just received confirmed reports of clashes in Namura, which is actually not very far from Nairobi, and 3 lorry loads of one community are now taking shelter at the Tigoni police station nearby.
Has
not completely returned.
So does this suggest that the wealthier areas are patrolled and protected by troops and police, and that the outlying communities are not?
No. What's happened is there are basically 3 forms of violence going on at this point in time, and have been for the last week. The first were sort of spontaneous, angry protests that were quite disorganized and anarchic, but protests, basically, and that were sort of destructively violent, involving destruction of property, injuries to people, rape, killing, and so on. That form seems to have largely been contained across the country. The second form, though, which we're much more concerned about, is what I would call organized militia activity, primarily in the Rift Valley, or starting in the Rift Valley, that led to the displacements of people. And in response, other militia organizations from different communities are starting to be activated. For instance, 2-3 days ago, we were informed from sources within the group itself that Mungiki has been reactivated and brought in to ostensibly provide security in the low-income areas, but of course they're also now on reprisal missions, which is what I suspect would have happened today in Nauru. And another militia group, Chinkorogo, has also been reactivated in the western part of the country, in Nyanza. So that's actually what we're concerned about, is the bringing into play of organized militia groups accountable to political paymasters. The third form of violence is really extraordinary use of force by the police and the general service unit in its ostensible, efforts to restore sort of peace and order and so on. There have been widespread reports confirmed of extrajudicial killings, particularly in the western part of the country and in some of the low-income areas in Nairobi.
Are the police and army politically neutral?
They so far have been behaving as though they're politically neutral, but we're made to understand that there are divisions even within the security forces now, given who is being drawn into what kind of discussions and who is being armed with what kind of sort of anti-riot materials.
And can you describe these militias that are allied to political parties? Are they organized along tribal lines, or what's the nature of the organization of these militias?
Oh yeah, they're very much around ethnic lines, and I think that's what's very important to get across. That I know the perception that comes across is as though people from different ethnic communities have suddenly, brought all of their grievances and so on into play and just started attacking one another. And what I want to make very clear is they haven't done that, which is not to deny that the grievances don't exist. But what has been brought into play are militia. And militia in Kenya have played different roles. Some of them begin as sort of identity-based organizations, are quickly co-opted, were co-opted by the state under the Moi regime, since then have been co-opted by different political players depending on, whatever scenarios at play. So during sort of times of political unrest, they function as political organizations. And more recently, I don't know if you heard about the kind of insecurity that happened earlier this year, because they had been ostensibly allowed to function as protection rackets. They had become, protection rackets until some of the people they were demanding protection from sort of resisted what it was costing them.
So
they morph, basically.
I see.
And take different shapes and forms depending on the situation at a given time.
So I guess the question then is are the militias who, I take it from what you're telling us, are driving the violence, what countervailing forces are there in terms of the two leaders, the winner of the disputed election and the challenger, apparently aren't speaking. The U.S. envoy is speaking with them separately. So how would you rate the chances of mediation versus the reality that the militias are loose?
Well, interestingly, it's not really the militia organizations that have been traditionally associated with the ethnic group of the person challenging the results of the presidential election that have been brought into play, at least not yet. It is those associated with the Kalenjin community, those associated with the Kikuyu community, and now the one I was talking about in Western Kenya, the Kisii community. The movement on the political front is really dependent on an admission by the man who was sworn in as president that the electoral anomalies and malpractices that we saw with respect to the counting and tallying of the presidential vote were so grave as to alter outcomes. That is fundamental. And I think that also needs to be understood, that this is not sort of a loser crying foul. This is also the considered opinion of groups like my own that had monitors across the country, and the collective of the human rights movement here, some of whom had observers in the verification process that took place the night before the announcement of the results. What happened was a stolen election. And so that needs to be admitted to. I think, though, that all of the efforts, the diplomatic efforts that are being made, are starting to bear fruit. We've seen ODM sort of shift from a position that, you know, before anything can happen, the president must just get out of, the man who was sworn in as president, rather, must just get out of State House. And it's moved two or three times over the last week, whereas the man who was sworn in as president and the Party of National Unity were remaining completely adamant and hardline until just a day or two ago. So they finally shifted as well. For us, that gives us hope. I don't think the shift that they've made is enough, but still, it means that the process is underway. We hope this will lead to a mediation. And the first task of that mediation, I think, would be to agree upon an independent electoral oversight body of some kind to show the country exactly what happened with the counting and tallying of the presidential vote. Depending on those results, then we can decide whether we need just a retelling or a recounting or a rerun. But the country actually needs to understand the full extent of the fraud that happened. And then they can agree on, you know, some sort of transitional arrangement.
So I take it that...
But
that,
I think...
I'm sorry, I was going to say that I take it that the fraud was so manifest and obvious to everybody. Is that true, that most people don't doubt that the election was stolen?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've never had a situation before where it takes 3 days to get presidential results in from constituencies in Nairobi to the tallying center. We've never had a situation before where, after the announcement of the result, no less than 4 electoral commissioners come out to say there needs to be a review of the process. No less than the chair has said he cannot verify who actually won the election. This is really significant. The initial reports released by some of the international observers, the European Union, showed that there were grave concerns. Similarly, the initial report released by the Kenyan Domestic Observers Forum showed that there were grave concerns. And I think what everyone has been doing is trying to sort of compile their data, do the analysis, and show the full extent of what those anomalies were. In the meantime, there were illegalities committed as well. For instance, you are not meant to announce results without supporting documentation that happened in several constituencies. If a party, any party to the process, asks for time for either a recount or retelling, that has to be done. That didn't happen. After the announcement of the result, time has to be given for aggrieved parties again to file their grievances in writing. That didn't happen. We went straight from an announcement to a very hastily convened swearing-in process. So there's issues of anomalies and malpractices, but there are also issues of illegality. And those illegalities make everything that came after also illegal. So our position really is that the man who was sworn in as president is not just there illegitimately, he is there illegally.
And it's pretty obvious that he essentially doesn't want to give up power. Is this does this characterize the kind of ruling political class there, that they simply can't part with their perks?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this is part of the problem. There are some very hardline people, obviously, arraigned around him who believe that their political survival is tied to his. They also believe their economic survival is tied to his. There's issues of his health, so this is also sort of an internal, although it's not discussed, an internal succession issue on the people on those sides, on that side. But like I say, a significant breakthrough was made yesterday when, even though this offer of being willing to sort of consider a government of national unity was rejected, because, of course, entering into that would legitimize a process that is illegitimate. Still, the man who was sworn in as president and people around him have made their first kind of step away from the initial hardline position that they maintained for almost a full week. That's progress. We just hope that the mediation that's being done by senior African statespeople will continue to bear fruit.
And Mutoni Wanyeke, just to touch on the other possibility that you mentioned, that organized violence or violence organized by militias, and that while it's calm in the middle class and in wealthier suburbs of Nairobi, it's not necessarily the case in the countryside. And there have been the occasional references made. I was going to say there's been the occasional references made to Rwanda. So give us a sense on how dire things could get.
No, like I said, really what's needed is for the government to relent a bit and allow legitimate and legal forms of protest, expand freedom of expression, assembly, association, and let people protest the way they need to protest through rallies, demonstrations, basically peaceful methods. That would lower tensions quite a bit. In terms of the militia reactivation, I think all of the human rights movement has been speaking very strongly and loudly, publicly as well as to different parties, political parties and groupings on the issue, making it very clear that this is our understanding of the issue. And, you know, we can only hope that that message will slowly begin to be heard.
And is the U.S. envoy there, Ms. Fraser, is she taken seriously?
I'm sorry?
Is the United States envoy there, Ms. Fraser, is she taken seriously?
I think her discussions with the man who is in State House were helped with moving their position, as I mentioned. But I think, you know, we could do with a little bit of a stronger position from the U.S., that's for sure. Britain has very diplomatically said they look forward to dealing with a legitimate government, which is quite a strong statement, actually. The EU has also been pretty clear. I think the Americans could be a bit clearer.
But just in closing, then, your feeling as the head of the Kenyan Human Rights Commission is that that even though there's been some violence and negotiations seem to be sort of inching forward towards some kind of resolution, just in the broader context of the disappointment that many feel that this country that was a model of stability has shown such fissures. Are you a little optimistic in the long term that things can be restored?
No, of course. I mean, we're disappointed here. There are colleagues who are disappointed all in across the broader East African region as well as within Africa at large. There are many efforts that have been taken up by colleagues at all levels across Africa to assist with the problem, whether it's getting our regional human rights mechanism involved, whether it's engaging with the AU, whether it's bringing former African heads of state together and so on. And, you know, everyone is fueled by the 5 years ago, we were a model of what was possible in a political sense. And in the 5 years since, we sort of also showed we were a model of what's possible economically. The idea, though, being peddled now that we just need to sort of get over this and go back to business as usual has been shown to be untrue. One of the colleagues with us, an economist who actually drafted the economic recovery strategy of the Kibaki government, who has been speaking out very loudly and strongly about the electoral fraud, has shown very clearly this is not something that we will recover from even if all violence ceased tomorrow and a settlement was reached tomorrow. The damage has been done. It's grave. I guess all I can say is it's a lesson to all of us not to take any gain that we have achieved lightly or for granted.
I thank you very much for joining us here today in Los Angeles from Nairobi, Mutoni Wanyeke.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Mutoni Wanyeke, who is in Nairobi, Kenya. She is the executive director of the Kenyan Human Rights Commission, a non-governmental organization. She's also a columnist for the weekly newspaper, The East African. Now let's go to the subject of the political earthquake that has shaken the establishments in both the Democratic and the Republican Party. Let's begin with the Democratic Party and speak with David Sirota, who's a political journalist and New York Times bestselling author of Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Will Take It Back. He's a nationally syndicated newspaper columnist. He writes a weekly nationally syndicated column for Creators Syndicate, which was launched in the fall of 2007. His writing appears in the Denver Post, San Francisco Chronicle, the Seattle Times, the Idaho Statesman, and others. David Sirota is also a senior editor at In These Times magazine. He's working on a second book due out in the spring of 2008, and he ran the successful campaign for Governor Schweitzer, who was a Democrat elected in the red state of Montana, and also Ned Lamont's campaign in Connecticut, until, of course, Senator Lieberman ran as an independent and was elected on Republican votes, and also worked for Senator Bernie Sanders. So David, did you work on his campaign or as an aide?
As an aide.
I see. And what was your response to this, I thought, an extraordinary event the other night?
I thought it was extraordinary also for a number of reasons. I thought the vote against Clinton, you know, 60 or the combined aggregate total was 60 or 65% against the Clinton machine was impressive. I actually thought the most interesting story, however, was on the Republican side, that you've got essentially an economic class warrior winning handily the Republican primary. And what's so fascinating is that you have the Republican primary is now basically being, well, I would say it's revolving around economic class-based politics, and that was the winner, Mike Huckabee in Iowa. And the Democratic winner was actually somebody, Barack Obama, who basically tries to ignore economic class and to a lesser extent race. I mean, he doesn't mention race, he doesn't mention economic class. He says that, you know, we're all, you know, the sort of the unity message. And I think that's I'm not making a value judgment on that. What I'm saying is that I think it's very interesting that the economic class battle is actually playing out more decisively in the Republican primary than it is in the Democratic primary, although of course John Edwards has been saying this message for months. But I think that says that there really is a realignment in politics going on right now that's much, much deeper than the individual candidates.
And of course the Republicans have always decried it whenever the Democrats mention economic the lack of economic fairness and the exponential and growing gap between the rich and the poor. They are always quick to accuse Democrats of class warfare, and it is an irony that the Republican candidate should be bringing this up. But of course, the Club for Growth and other of the parts of the Republican establishment are just throwing money to try and defeat him.
That's right, and I think that's a predictable result of this. You know, what's gone on in Republican politics and actually American politics is that there has been pretty vicious class politics that has been waged for decades and decades. It hasn't been overt in that it's not called class politics, but we definitely have a class politics system where the very, very wealthy is waging, you know, on the policy level, on the political level, is waging a pretty vicious class war and using American politics to do it. What is fascinating is that this is if not the first election, then the first election in quite a while where the other thing is happening. It's happening the other way around, that a lower and middle class based populism and politics is being forged in both the Democratic and Republican primaries, but that at least in Iowa that politics was victorious in that primary. And in the Democratic primary, what was victorious was a candidate who essentially ignores economic class. And it's hard to say what that's going to mean, but it definitely suggests some sort of realignment happening here. The old Republican coalition is breaking apart, where you've got lower and middle class religious conservatives who are starting to vote or potentially vote both their social conservatism but also their potential economic populism. And you know, with the Democrats, you know, it's hard to say what's going on in the party there. I mean, I think Barack Obama invokes a sort of politics that we all wish this country had. My concern with Obama, substantively, is that American politics, and if history is any gauge, you know, doing things in American politics is not about necessarily bringing people together and making everybody feel happy. You know, do any great thing that's happened in our history has happened through what John Edwards would call an epic battle. And I think if Obama really thinks that the way to pass universal health care is to make everybody in the health care debate happy, you know, I'm a little nervous about that.
But David Sirota, it's obvious that in terms of Obama trying to raise the political discourse to a kind of lofty level, you know, the class warfare issues are totally the campaign of Edwards. I mean, so in other words, there's not a lot of room for anybody else to beat that drum. And so much of what both Edwards and Clinton characterized in their campaign is so much about them. The egotism is so palpable. It seems to me that Obama is actually being very, very clever to, and so is Huckabee. They're both doing the same thing. They're both saying, this is not about me, 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 me. This is about you, the voter.
I would agree with that. I think that is a very astute analysis that rhetorically, though Huckabee and Obama are talking about how the race is about the public, and I think that's very smart. Again, what I think remains to be seen is with Huckabee is whether this can carry into different states, and with Obama, I think the underlying question is, look, what do voters think is the real problem in American politics? Is the real problem that politicians in Washington aren't nice enough to each other, don't talk nicely enough to each other, and if we get them to be nicer to each other and hold hands, we can solve our problems? Or is the problem that there are entrenched interests that we need to marshal power against? My substantive concern with Barack Obama is that he believes the former rather than the latter. I think he's run a very, very good, spirited campaign. He's brought a lot of new people into the process. I think he should be commended for that. My concern with Obama is less political and more substantive. But obviously, in the context of political engagement, both Huckabee and Obama are changing the archetype of politics. And I'm one of these people who thinks that any time you shake up the status quo, it's a good thing.
And David Sirota, we'll be joined in later by John Dean, obviously somebody who's watched his party, the Republican Party, be captured by the religious conservatives. But that's always been a very cynical arrangement. The party power brokers, the corporatists, and the wealthy Bush and Romney-like oligarchs, if you will, they've. There's not enough of them to win, and they need people to go out there and vote. So they've made this kind of arrangement with the religious right and the social conservatives, almost in a class way, as you mentioned. We've been talking about class, that it's almost an upstairs downstairs thing. And what's happening with Huckabee is that the downstairs people who are supposed to shut up and vote and not be seen. As Pat Buchanan would say, they've got their pitchforks out and they're marching towards Washington.
That's right. And I think what was fascinating was there was very little notice. There was a story in the New York Times where they interviewed people. This was before the primary, probably 2 weeks ago, where they interviewed a number of conservatives about Huckabee, and opinion was split. You know, the economic conservatives criticized him, and some of the social conservative leaders didn't say anything because they didn't want to, you know, break up the Republican coalition. But Grover Norquist, the lead, arguably the lead economic conservative in Washington, who runs the anti-tax group Americans for Tax Reform, He basically said at the end of the article, you know, I really wish Huckabee would just go revive the Christian Coalition and get social conservatives to continue supporting what he called the Reagan-Goldwater Coalition. Now, if you read between the lines, what he was saying there was, I really wish Mike Huckabee would shut up and go focus on getting religious conservatives to continue supporting my royalist economic agenda. And that's really the fissure here. You know, regardless of who wins this primary, the most interesting story about this election has already been written, in that we are finally seeing, finally, this unholy alliance in the Republican Party being exposed for what it is, unholy, asking religious conservatives, many middle and lower middle class people, to ignore the economic tenets of their spirituality. You know, the meek shall inherit the earth, give to the poor. The Republican Party asked those people to ignore the economic tenets of their religious conservatism and only focus on their social conservatism, and we're seeing an uprising of people saying, you know what, it's both. It's both the social conservatism and it is the religious-based economic altruism. And you know, I think that's a very good thing. That's a good development.
Well, indeed, you can see that it's got, as I say, the Club for Growth and these other people are apoplectic about it. And there's no question that Huckabee is an extremely effective candidate. I think he's scary good, if you will.
He is. And let me just say one other thing that I find also fascinating in terms of how the media is communicating all this. You know, there's a lot of talk, you hear a lot of these comments from Washington pundits, many conservative, berating Huckabee for being a sort of a bumpkin, a country bumpkin. He's kind of, it's sort of implying that he's kind of stupid, and people have focused on a couple of gaffes he's made, and this is mostly from Washington. This is another really interesting thing. Like George Bush, when he ran, people sort of joked about how he didn't come off as super intelligent, and talked a little bit about how he didn't have any foreign policy experience, but it never became a sort of cacophony, claiming that this was the central reason why this man could never be allowed to be president. When the same thing is being said about Huckabee, that basically, a lot of people are basically implying this guy it would be dangerous to have him as president because he's not smart enough. And what's the difference? And then you ask the question, what is the difference? And the difference to me, as I see it, is Mike Huckabee is a guy who really did come from absolutely nowhere, did not come from the Ivy League, did not come up through the establishment channels, and George Bush, as sort of intellectually incapable as he is, he came up through the establishment, through the Ivy League. He was the son of a president. And so what we're seeing here is there really is, I think, underlying all of it is a class resentment against Huckabee from the establishment. These people in professional politics, in professional Republican politics, are loath to support somebody who they have gotten used to looking down on. And again, I think this is going to reshape politics for the long haul.
Well, I must say, Huckabee's performance in the Republican debate on ABC, they ran them back to back. I thought it was actually very effective in both cases. No question that, to my mind, that Huckabee was far the best candidate, the most polished, the quickest, the wittiest, and he was substantive too. And he was elevating the discourse in the way that Obama has done on the Democratic side. So, I'd say welcome to their pain.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And look, I think again, anything that shakes up the moneyed establishment in this country, anything that riles it up is I think a good thing. And the thing that we should all be watching for is that, you know, and again, to go back to comparing Obama and Huckabee, I would submit that the moneyed establishment is far more comfortable with a Barack Obama presidency than a Mike Huckabee presidency. And I think that speaks to what's really going on here.
But David, did you notice that in the Republican debate on ABC, almost all of them were wrapping themselves in Obama's mantle? I have never seen Republicans embrace a Democrat in the way that they have embraced and want to be associated with Obama.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And to me, again, as somebody who considers myself a progressive, I'm not trying to criticize Obama, but it makes me take a pause and say, okay, why are people like George Will, the super conservative columnist,
David Brooks as well?
Yeah, right. Why is he writing good things about Barack Obama? Why are big Republican donors saying good things about Barack Obama? Why have hedge fund managers given the most amount of money to Barack Obama? What does that mean substantively? When we get beyond the rhetoric, what does that mean substantively under an Obama administration? That's what gets me worried.
But David, there may also be a benign explanation for this, and that is that the hedge fund managers, I can't speak for George Will and David Brooks, and I'd be leery of their endorsements, but it's quite possible that these people, these rich Republicans, are listening to their kids. I mean, when you think about it, Obama's coalition is unbeatable. It is the baby boomer parents and their baby boomer kids who are in their early 20s. That's an unbeatable coalition.
I definitely think politically, I can see the idea that people are getting on a moving train. I get that. What I'm saying is that, and it's not to echo John Edwards' line too much, but he said, you know, if you take all the money from these people and you take all the support from these people, you can't really confront these people. You can't really challenge them. And so that's the thing that I worry about with Obama. The other thing I worry about with him is, you know, if you take this out to its logical conclusion, what is the mandate if Barack Obama wins on the current trajectory with the current message? The mandate to me is, he says he wants to change the way politics is conducted. Very good goal. But if that's the mandate isn't necessarily to do any one thing other than change the process. And we've seen a very recent example of how such a mandate can endanger a politician in New York State. Eliot Spitzer was elected basically without a mandate, basically on a cult of personality promising to change the way Albany worked. Now, the problem for Spitzer was the moment he pushed something substantive. Okay, anything you push substantive creates division. On the flip side, anything that passes, for instance, the United States Senate with a 85-5 or 99-0 vote, anything that brings people together in politics tends to be not substantive. So the problem is, if Obama is elected with only a mandate to change the process, he doesn't necessarily have a mandate to do any one substantive piece of an agenda. And the moment that substantive piece of an agenda comes up, it's almost impossible to live up to the rhetoric that he was elected upon.
Well, just in closing, David Sirota, let's look at Hillary Clinton. Obviously, she can't be counted out. I understand the Clinton machine is extremely distressed. And for some time, I think Clinton, the former president, has watched his wife's handlers flounder. They clearly have made some terrible tactical mistakes, one of which was even putting too much emphasis on Iowa in the first place when their chances weren't that great. And you get the impression that they're in a bit of disarray. I know that they're mad as hell at Bill Richardson. Apparently he stabbed them in the back and threw his support to Obama, which then pushed Clinton down to the number three spot, which it perhaps otherwise wouldn't have done. But I think she's got an almost impossible task on her hands in New Hampshire. And in South Carolina, the 60% of the Democrats are African Americans, and they've watched an African American candidate just get elected by an almost 99% white state. So that nonsense about Obama not being black enough, that's got to be over.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think Clinton is positioned very, very poorly. I think I've thought this for a long time, is that she she's resorted to saying she's already been making change, and I don't think anybody believes, it's hard to point to an era that the current political dynamic is revolting against and cite it as a record of success. I've told a friend of mine months ago, I said, if I were Hillary Clinton, what I would have said from the beginning was, on an issue, for instance, like health care, I pushed universal health care back then. I got defeated. I was right back then, and I'm right today to continue pushing it. As opposed to sort of what she said on that issue, and in general, she sort of said, look, I've had the experience of going through these battles. As opposed to making it more of a principle-based insurgency. And I think that's what the political system, the political dynamic right now wants. It wants an insurgency. It wants candidates who challenge the status quo. Hillary Clinton continues to say, I've operated within the status quo and I've made gains inside the status quo. And we're beyond that. The political dynamic wants a wholesale change to the status quo. And Clinton has, she has inherent disadvantages in trying to adapt to that. And I think she has reinforced those inherent disadvantages by running a campaign that has not been thematically appreciative of the current political topography.
I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles today.
That's great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just being in then with David Sirota, nationally syndicated columnist. He ran the successful campaign for elected Governor Schweitzer in the red state of Montana, Ned Lamont in Connecticut, and worked for Senator Bernie Sanders. I'm now speaking to John Dean, who before becoming counsel to the President of the United States in 1970, is at age 31, John Dean was the Chief Minority Counsel to the Judiciary Committee of the United States House of Representatives, the Associate Director of the Law Reform Commission, and Associate Deputy Attorney General of the United States. He served as Richard Nixon's White House lawyer for 1,000 days. He's authored 8 books in total, the most recent being Conservatives Without Conscience, and his latest, Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches. And John Dean, clearly the other night in Iowa, we experienced a political earthquake, both in terms of the Democratic Party establishment and the Republican Party establishment. I would argue that the Republican Party establishment is even more in disarray, somewhat hysterical. The Club for Growth is throwing money to trying to defeat Huckabee. Is this rather like an upstairs-downstairs scenario where the people that run the Republican Party, the wealthy, powerful, and the corporatists, have always played footsie rather cynically with the religious right? They only need them to show up and vote. And now there's a revolt on their hands.
That's very true. I would not disagree with your argument at all. It's been a fascinating fracturing that has been really long in the making. It was sort of a three-way or three-legged stool they put together with the economic conservatives, business conservatives, then the social conservatives and the religious right, along with the traditional conservatives. And three-legged stools, if you lose a leg, you're in trouble. And they have, what's happened in Iowa is very clear that the legs aren't standing together anymore.
But don't you think Huckabee is an extraordinarily effective candidate? His performance last night on the debate on ABC was flawless.
He's very smooth, very good, very articulate. He doesn't have a lot of national background, but he's appropriately glib, and he's got his own charismatic style that I think attracts the religious right. And they're now starting to look at his record. I think that's what's starting to terrify the big money, that he may actually care about the poor and do some things that one would think a good Baptist might do instead of just show up and vote, as you say.
So this is sort of a red state Williams Jennings Bryan.
Well, it could be. It could be. You know, what's interesting is this whole mood and call for change, where both Obama has made that the theme of his campaign, and has the governor of Arkansas. I think when both of them are doing that, it's kind of odd, because I'm cynical of being a longtime Washington insider, but I've seen others come in saying how we're going to change Washington, and Washington ends up changing the outsider. It's inevitable, and I don't know if Hillary Clinton has just reached that conclusion ahead of other candidates, and she realizes the real world, because when she and her husband came in, they certainly came in with grand ideas of change, and found it just doesn't work that way. The system can't be overturned overnight. There's a real Washington establishment that there are ways and customs that have to be honored and dealt with. And, you know, it's very hard, you know, to take Jimmy Carter, who was very much a change candidate when he came in the post-Watergate era. Well, you know, the system beat him up. He really never did get his hands around it and didn't really last very long either. He only got one term. So this may be a great way to get elected. I'm just not so sure it's a great way to govern, because I think you have to do work with the system.
Well, I suppose you can you could make that argument in defense of Hillary Clinton. After all, it was the Democratic establishment in Washington that essentially sabotaged Clinton's early presidency from 92 to 94. He got nothing done, even though the Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House. And I think in large part because of the big Democratic mandarins on the Hill who thought this upstart from Arkansas was in fact a hick, and the Republicans thought he was not legitimate because Perot had helped him.
Right.
So he went into a buzzsaw with both his own party and the Republicans gunning for him. I guess this is a long-winded way of saying that perhaps the fact that you get a do-over in politics, as the Clintons will, if she gets elected, makes sense because it takes you the first 4 years to figure out what's going on, and then the next 4 years you're desperately trying to run out the clock.
I actually write about that in Broken Government, because one of the things I, you know, sort of narrowing down the field without any, I have no candidate that I carry water for. I don't care who is nominated or elected, just so long as we don't have four more years of Republicans. They terrify me. They worry me. They've done a lot to break down the system. So I'm watching the Democrats with the hope that they will get in there and win and stay in there, not just four, but maybe 8 or 12 years to get the system back on balance. So I'm pulling for them without being a proponent of any one of them.
I have to warn you, John Dean, that if when you're on the side of the left or trying to help them, you're on the right side with the wrong people quite often.
You're right. I'm sure they don't want my help. So as I say, I'm pulling for them and just trying to point out to voters how important it is we get this change. But I'm worried that they'll get in there and you have somebody who's new. And the only person who really does, I would take a Biden, has a lot of experience. A Chris Dodd has a lot of experience. They're both out of play. Hillary has experience. In a sense, the ones who are really probably the ones who are most able to run Washington and get something done are the ones who are being excluded.
Well, I don't think, though, John Dean, you're entirely given up being a Republican. You've been working on a book about Goldwater, and there obviously the Goldwater Republicans are like dinosaurs. In this case, of course, with Huckabee.
Well, a Goldwater Republican is probably a moderate Democrat today.
Right. but that's not to say that there is. That the constituency is totally extinct. And I'm curious to know from you whether there is a way to revive that constituency and whether the Democrats, whether it's Obama or Clinton, and obviously at this point it's much more likely to be Obama, that there's a way that they can give those Republicans the comfort factor to vote Democrat for the first time. Or do you think that the New York mayor, Bloomberg, will exploit this
That could
opening.
Well happen. That could well happen. That's the vulnerability. The Goldwater Republican, I call them Goldwater Conservatives, actually, because there's so few of that are now in the Republican Party, the Goldwater Conservatives. They're mostly in the independent file now. They really don't want any part of the Republican Party. They don't like where the religious right has taken it. They don't like to see the social issues dominating. They're not opposed to the economic issues because they have a sympathy for those, but they're really libertarians, and they want government out of everybody's back. Now, Ron Paul is not going to be nominated, and he sure as hell not going to be elected.
Boy, you see the way they beat up on him. They gang up on him. They don't like hearing anything that he has to say.
And that's probably as close to the Goldwater Republic or Coldwater conservatism as you're going to find. And whether the Democrats can ever reach out and get that crowd, I doubt it. Bloomberg could well come in and tap into that independent vote.
And that would basically kill the Democrats, wouldn't it?
It would.
And
not impossible. It's not impossible we develop a third party in this country, an independent party.
Right.
And if there's anybody who has the money to do it, it's certainly a Bloomberg.
Right. And he could,
in other words, what I'm saying is he could get elected.
Of course. And he's got people like Lou Dobbs shilling for him. So what about this extraordinary phenomenon last night on ABC with the debate for the Republicans first, Democrats second? I thought it was very effective, actually. But
I liked it, too.
First time, I think you have to give ABC credit for that. But wasn't it extraordinary to see all those Republicans wrapping themselves or attempting to wrap themselves in Obama's mantle? I've never seen a group of Republicans more promoting a Democrat.
I think they can beat him.
Oh, they want him, you think?
Yes. Well, I've heard a lot of my Republican friends say, nominate Obama, please.
I see. Well, I've always been suspicious of that. Why conservative Republican columnists like George Will and David Brooks keep promoting Obama? It does seem to me to be perhaps suspicious that they don't want Hillary.
Exactly. Hillary terrifies them for many reasons. Not only that she could be elected, that she could actually govern.
Having had the experience, you mean, were talking about earlier, that she gets to do a do-over, at least with Bill, but...
Well, you know, here's the thing. What happened is, notwithstanding having had a little Washington experience, when Bill Clinton came in, they really did spend the first 2 years trying to find out, you know, how the machinery even operates. And it takes more than that. It takes a good Washington exposure to know how to make that machine go. Now, Hillary Clinton does have that. There's no question that of the entire field on the Democratic side that's in play, she's the most experienced. She had strong competition as far as experience with a Biden and a Chris Dodd. Bill Richardson really is, you know, he's got Washington experience, but he doesn't have the same level of experience. He's never been in the Senate. He's did serve in the House. He's got more executive experience than he does congressional. And that congressional experience helps tremendously.
Well, he was a 12-year congressman.
Right, in the House.
Yeah. But I tell you, he is absolutely in the doghouse with the Clintons. He threw his votes in Iowa to Obama, and
they had definitely established that did happen?
I think so. I mean, that's what I hear. I don't know
what... Well, that's what's been rumored, but, you know, he, of course, denied it when asked, that I heard. But if they establish that to be a fact, that he did throw his caucuses to Obama, he's
toast if they get in. Yeah.
He's toast with the Clintons for sure.
Right, because if that's true, it would have probably put her in third place as opposed to second place, which would have been less humiliating. You know, she's a good candidate, but she's been she like Edwards, I think, have this irritating posture of unbridled egotism. It's all about me, 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 me.
Small egos do not become president.
Well, but you have to combine that with the fact that Hillary appears to have a pretty poor campaign, and Bill has apparently been tearing his hair out on the sidelines. Do you think she can put it back together? I mean, I have a feeling that Obama's going to win, and we'll be talking about it on Tuesday night. Obviously, the results will be in from New Hampshire, but what would your sense be? My feeling is it'll probably be Obama first and her second.
Yet anything can happen at this early date. You never know. There's nothing inevitable about the current political field. There could be, you know, Obama could trip. He's not a highly experienced candidate either. So I think it's up for grabs. But I think that she's in trouble. Obviously, we had another poll came in today in New Hampshire that showed Obama is now widening his lead. They went in about even. She was once ahead, so he's certainly getting some slingshot momentum from Iowa into New Hampshire. But it's that Fat Tuesday that is the one that is probably going to either make or break everybody.
And and Obama is much better positioned in South Carolina with 60% of the Democrats being African Americans. And surely by now they've gotten over this idea of he's black enough if a bunch of white people just elected him in Iowa. Just in closing, I read a really good piece this week in the LA Times by Dan Schnur, the Republican operative who ran McCain's successful 2000 campaign in New Hampshire, which, of course, McCain is trying to repeat. Schnur's observation was that the Republican establishment likes to choose people quietly in back rooms. They chose, unfortunately, the macaca from Virginia as the perfect candidate who could be both the corporate interest and bridge that with the Christian conservatives. And then when Allen self-destructed, it left the field open, and none of these guys that are running are really authentic because they're all trying to woo the Christian right, who's not their normal constituency.
Well, the rank and file of the Christian right had made their call when the leaders were meeting in Washington and looking at Romney and everybody accepting Huckabee. Huckabee, it was getting the grassroots vote even then, because the grassroots finds him to be one of them.
Well, he is. I thank you for joining us here in Los Angeles today, John Dean. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with John Dean, and he's the author of a number of books, the latest being Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Executive, Legislative, and Judicial Branches. We're talking about the earthquakes in both the Democratic and the Republican parties following Iowa, the surprise results. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the assistant producers, Elliot Fong and Lick Duan, and the engineer today, Nadja Richardson.